You've done it. You've reanimated the woolly mammoth.
It's a thing of beauty.
It was never meant to be. Can't you see, Arthur? This is just your vanity and ambition running wild.
I did it for the people of this town. It's going to create jobs, this woolly mammoth. I did it for the working folks of Camden, New Jersey.
You did?
I think so. But I also did it for us, my darling. I did it for love.
You did?
I think so. Actually, I forget why I did it. Why did I reanimate a woolly mammoth?
Cut. God, you are both horrible at this. I may have Scarlett Johansson redub both parts. Do you even understand the scene? It's the key to the whole movie. It's about excess and connections and the abolition movement and the flowering and fading of a young lesbian relationship and struggling against the elements.
It is?
I don't get that at all.
It's also a subtle retelling of Streetcar Named Desire, right? With the mammoth as Blanche?
That went way over my head.
The truth is, I've kind of lost track of what this movie is about. And now it's going to be released with your terrible acting, and critics like Edelstein and Scott are going to just tear me apart, those bastards. They've been lying in wait for a decade, drooling at the chance to bring me down. Why did I make The Mammoth Awakes? Why? On the other hand, I do think we'll do pretty well in overseas markets. So let's pick it up with Arthur saying, I did it for love, okay? Meanwhile, in our show today, America's two greatest living film critics. And now he plays the paleoproctologist in The Mammoth Awakes, Colin McEnroe.
I played kind of DeForest Kelly, kind of, you know, panicking a lot, and it's dark and dirty in there, Jim, that kind of thing. And I don't think it's axiomatic that The Mammoth Awakes will get bad reviews. It depends on how it's interpreted by the critics. And we do have critics on the show here today. In just one moment, you'll meet them. Actually, well, you'll meet one of them. Oh, no, we have both of them now. Okay. So let me just tell you what's going to go on here. Not that I really know what's going to go on here. But we have America's greatest living film critic, David Edelstein from New York Magazine, Fresh Air, and CBS Sunday Morning. And then America's other greatest living film critic, A.O. Scott from The New York Times. They're both with us right now. We're going to talk through movies today. First of all, welcome to both of you. Gentlemen, do we have you on the air?
Yes, hello.
Yeah, that sounds like Tony Scott.
I'm here. I'm waiting. I'm ready.
Okay, you're waiting and you're ready.
I'm ready.
So I sent you guys a list of some ideas to tick through. And obviously another thing that we have before us are competing 10 best lists. And I know David wants to pit his 10 best list against Tony's 10 best list. But let's start somewhere else. And we'll
I just want to say I love Tony's 10 best list. To poop on!
Well, there's an awful lot of overlap. Let's not exaggerate the differences here. I see a bunch of movies that we both liked. All is Lost, Blue is the Warmest Color, American Hustle, The Act of Killing, Much Ado About Nothing.
Yeah, well, that's because you larded your 10 best list with like 30 movies.
I'm looking at yours now. Yours. I can't even scroll down to the bottom of it. Come on, man. But what do you want to fight with me about?
He wants to fight with you about the movie. He wants to fight about the movie Her, which I believe is David's favorite movie of the year. Maybe that's a good place to start with the movie Her, which is not Tony Scott on your 10 best list. This is a movie that will open in this market, the one that you're listening to right now, tomorrow. Unfortunately, it stars Joaquin Phoenix as a lovelorn man living in an unnamed but near future period, who forms a relationship with a sort of somewhat sentient machine of some kind, voiced by Scarlett Johansson. So let's start with David. Why was this your best movie of the year?
Well, this was not just my best movie of the year. It's my best movie of the last few years. I mean, just on a sort of basic entertaining level, it begins, it has almost a sci-fi satirical screwball vibe with this sad sack played by Joaquin Phoenix in the middle of the frame. He's a guy whose job is writing letters to people, very intimate, sometimes erotic letters to people who can't do it themselves, and yet in his own life he's just terribly inexpressive. He's drifted apart from his wife, played by Rooney Mara, and he, you know, sees her in these lyrical, longing visions, and then he gets this OS, this newfangled operating system. She's like the 31st generation of Siri or something. And he connects with her as he's connected with nothing else in his life. And then she begins to evolve. And you're laughing at it and you're thinking, oh, this is very satirical. But it kind of stops being satirical and it becomes transcendentally romantic. And finally, and I don't want to give anything away, but she kind of evolves beyond him. And you're left with this at once romantic and yet very sad vision of the human incapacity fully to merge with another being. I know I'm sounding high-flown here, but the movie is high-flown and beautifully, lyrically so, so that it becomes a really profound meditation on humanity, much more so than on this kind of silly joke about an operating system that has, you know, sex with a guy. So that's my case for this amazing movie. I'm only sorry it's only opening tomorrow in Hartford, and in fact across the country. It's one of these movies that only opened in Los Angeles and New York to qualify for the stupid awards. You've got a bunch of things opening in Hartford tomorrow, I know.
We do, in fact. And let's hear just a tiny, tiny little clip of her, which we were at least able to pull for you.
Get up!
You're too funny.
I know you're living in my mind.
Theodore, I saw in your emails that you'd gone through a breakup recently.
You're kind of nosy.
Am I? You'll get used to it. So what was it like being married?
There's something that feels so good about sharing your life with somebody.
How do you share your life with somebody?
I think that's actually from the trailer. So, Tony Scott, first of all, I said in an email earlier today, it intrigues me. I mean, we have a series of movies about sentient machines. So
yeah.
almost 50 years ago, I think it's a little bit less than that right now. We had 2001. We had HAL. And so HAL becomes sentient. The more sentient he becomes, the more dangerous he becomes.
And don't forget Colossus, the Forbin Project.
Right.
And all the Terminator movies.
Right,
you
exactly.
Have to understand. Her goes, I don't mean to butt in on Tony. I'll give you your say, but her is very surprising in that it goes in the complete opposite direction.
Well, I wondered about that, because HAL is about a system that fails, and Terminator, to a certain degree, is about a system that fails us anyway. And I'm wondering whether this is kind of a different kind, as we get closer, and as theorists like Kurzweil start talking about singularity, about the notion that this really may happen fairly soon, is this more a movie about us as a failed system?
Well, I think one thing is that the emotions that these machines evoke have changed, and also the I think it's important that the source of these machines has also changed. I mean, the Terminator, that was a government project that went terribly wrong. I think that HAL was probably the same, and we're now in the world with her of these consumer electronics that are not these, don't appear to us as these gigantic imperial systems, but as these nice things that we buy. And the premise that her takes off from is that we love this stuff. We love all of these products. We go to the Apple store and we get our iPads, and it's so exciting. I mean, when Joaquin Phoenix first gets the new operating system, you can totally relate to that feeling of like, oh, wow, I got this new thing. I'm going to install it and play with it, and it's going to be so much fun. So the sort of affection that we have, the romance that we already have with these machines, is where the movie takes off from. One of the things that I think is ingenious about it is that instead of imagining that these machines are going to want to take over and enslave us, it imagines that they'll just kind of get tired of us.
They'll evolve beyond language, beyond us.
Yeah, that we've engineered these things that are superior to us, and the last thing that they want to do is, like, dominate us and destroy us. They just don't care because they have their own, you know, universe that they exist in that we can't even imagine. And I think that's a very, very witty and kind of a new thing in this science fiction trope that's existed for a very long time. I mean, goes back even, you know, to Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, right? The idea that we're going to build these creatures that are going to cause us all kinds of problems when they become
like us. That we're not worthy of, that get away from us, that elude our our grasp when we try to play God. But in this case, Tony, I think you'll agree that underneath there's a kind of longing for the singularity. Spike Jonze is longing. He's showing a man, and I presume this is autobiographical, at least of the soul, chafing against the limits of his own humanity, longing to be somehow enhanced. And you could argue that, I think at a certain point, the movie kind of leaves the realm that you were talking about our gizmos and our affection for these new gizmos. In a way, that's kind of the way it slips in. You know, that's the way it gets us, because we can relate to him opening up that, looking at that OS for the first time and imagining what it can do for him. But in the end, it's really a movie, I think it's a movie about his failed marriage to Sofia Coppola, down to the fact that he has Scarlett Johansson voicing her, Samantha, played... who was the stand-in for Sofia Coppola in Lost in Translation.
Yeah.
So why wasn't it on your 10 best list, man?
I put it in the runners-up. There's a lot of movies. I think it's a lovely movie. It did not. I'm not capable of adding as much breath to my voice as you are to evoke these things. I'm very impressed that you can do that. By the way, it's almost like what Scarlett Johansson did.
That's just marvelously condescending. It becomes about my feeling, and, you know, my.
Well, your 10 best list is about your feelings. If it's about anything, I did not find it as transcendently romantic as you did. My number one movie was much more unequivocally about a total failure of human feeling inside Lumen Davis, who I related to more than any other character.
Well, I want to shift over to that, actually, because we have an interesting situation here in which each critic's favorite film is not at all, I think, on the other's list. And so your favorite movie of the year, Tony Scott, was Inside Lumen Davis, directed by the Coen brothers.
Yes.
And tell us why.
Well, I found it transcendently anti-romantic, but I found it to be kind of in a way that many of the Coen brothers movies have been formally meticulous, and there's a sort of perfection in the way this movie looks, in the pacing, in the shooting, in the writing, that is kind of what you expect from them. But there is, I found a kind of unexpected depth of feeling in this, and it's a feeling that's very hard to specify or to describe. But it's this melancholy, slightly cynical, but also very heartfelt mood that the movie casts. And it's really a movie about failure, and it's pretty rigorously about this character messing up his own life, his own chances, being the victim of his own incompetence and the usual Coen brothers hostile universe, and being punished for various things he has and hasn't done. And yet he's also a talented artist and can only really express the person that's in there, the soul that he seems to lack in most of his interpersonal actions when he's singing. And the performance by Oscar Isaac is just one of the most extraordinary things I've seen in a long time, because he's a very good musician. He was a good guitar player and singer when he came to the project and learned this style, this not very easy style of finger picking that Lewin Davis uses. And the movie is built around these performances where he will be in the middle of the frame performing an entire song, and that's what carries the meaning and the feeling of the movie. So I love it in many different ways, and I've seen it a lot of times now, and its spell has not yet broken.
One thing that I have heard, I've seen it once and immediately wanted to see it again, because I felt I went in there with a bunch of expectations based partly on my knowledge of the folk scene and based on, even more on what I think a Coen Brothers movie is likely to be, and it was sort of none of those things. And I you know, David, one thing that I brought up with you a couple of days ago was that idea also that it's just kind of an unusual movie in the sense that it sort of is a big box office movie. I mean, it gets big, you know, full page advertisements in the New York Times and things like that. But it's not a movie that really unfolds its meaning immediately, right? It's a movie that if you're going to like it at all, you really almost have to think about it for a while, which I'm not sure American audiences are really comfortable doing.
Well, I know a lot of sort of regular audiences. I hate to say that because I always expect an audience to rise to the occasion, but do find it its bleakness off-putting. I loved it and hated it. I found its bleakness off-putting. See, everything that Tony said was beautiful and eloquent, and I couldn't disagree with anything. Except what bothers me about the Coen brothers is that the twain doesn't meet. You have this venal world. You have this world in which the Coens do throw everything they can at this protagonist, sort of fiendishly to make his life worse and worse. His options, you know, get narrower and narrower. He is hoist on the petard of his own selfishness. And then you have this other dimension. It's absolutely exquisite, heartfelt music that, you know, as Tony said, is so beautifully performed. And the Coens have sort of done this before with their soundtracks, and they exist in two different spheres. And it's their point of view that one does not inform the other. Do you know what I mean? It's this sort of Amadeus fallacy. I hate Amadeus. I know everybody loves it, but it's this idea that, you know, the artist and the artist's life are entirely 100% separate. There's no spillover between them.
I don't agree with that at all, actually. I mean, I think that the whole poignancy of the movie is in the gap between them, in the fact that, you know, that as a species we fail, and as individuals we fail in so many different ways, but we sometimes succeed in creating beautiful artifacts that express precisely the depth of the humanity that we're often otherwise unable to get out of us. And I think
I find that insupportable. Tony, I find that insupportable. I
find it accurate, I have to say.
Well, there we go. This is and obviously that's the Coen's
difference. There we
go. Well, yeah, I mean that is the Coen's worldview. That is how they express it. I can't quite go there.
Well, I've never really seen them express it before in this, because in their previous, I mean, you know, Barton Fink is sort of close to this, but Barton Fink is a pretentious hack, and Larry Gopnik in Serious Man is just a sort of a nebbish. Lewin Davis is something a little more complicated and a little more interesting and a little closer to maybe what we can relate to.
Maybe so, but by taking that scene, that sort of pre-Dylan Greenwich Village folk scene, and purposely scrubbing it of politics, scrubbing it of, you know, any awareness of something really exciting building here, some kind of, you know, connection among all these people, even in their poverty, even in sometimes venal show business settings. You know, the Coens just leave that out. That doesn't fit, and they can't make room for that in their sort of hermetically sealed sourness. And I'm not talking about the music, because don't forget, their soundtracks have always existed in counterpoint. You had The Lady Killers, a film that, you know, a lot of people don't like, in which you have these broad, you know, idiot crooks. And then you have these gorgeous spirituals. I mean, the soundtrack is really beautiful. You have Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, with its landmark soundtrack. I agree with you. This is
if anything, it's even better.
In fact, you know, I read a tweet the other day, you know, in the newspaper that said, you know, that sort of
you read half a tweet in the newspaper
all day just
my
sitting and listening
twisted
to the
and distorted.
We have to explain what's being talked about, which is actually it's turned into a little mini story in and of itself. The other day, one of our two guests, our guests today, by the way, are David Edelstein and A.O. Scott, both film critics, and if you want to be part of the conversation, 860-275 877-725-7266. But not too long ago, A.O. Scott tweeted something. Do you remember exactly what it was that you tweeted?
Yes. Okay. I have to give a little bit of context.
Yes.
On Twitter, there was a lot of critical grandstanding and arguing about Wolf of Wall Street and American Hustle. In particular, there was the diehard Martin Scorsese auteurist cult who was taking out against everyone, including our friend Mr. Edelstein, who dared to say anything critical about Wolf of Wall Street.
I didn't read this, by the way.
You don't need to bother yourself with it. But it was kind of, you know, going around the usual stuff about, does Wolf of Wall Street glorify its character, or does it show contempt for him? And an odd byproduct of the defense of Wolf of Wall Street is people putting down David O. Russell's American Hustle, which is somehow, you know, imagined to be like the worst version of what Scorsese's movie is. We can talk about those movies later. But
you will.
So I was, as often happens on Twitter, this was just kind of going on and on, and there was a lot of posturing and accusations and counter-accusations. And I participated for a while, and then I tweeted, "You guys keep fighting about Wolf of Wall Street and American Hustle. I'm going to go listen to the Llewyn Davis soundtrack again, Fare Thee Well, My Honeys," which is a reference to the song, Dink's song, that appears twice on that album. And that was that. That I thought was that. You know, some Llewyn Davis fans retweeted that tweet, but I didn't really. You know, I mean, it's an ephemeral medium. It was a tweet. It was gone. And then a little while later, I got an email from a publicist working on Inside Llewyn Davis, wondering if they could use my ad in my tweet in an advertisement, and if they could change it because the Academy's rules say you can't have the name of a rival picture in your for your consideration advertisement. So they wanted to get rid of Wolf of Wall Street and American Hustle. And I said no. I said, I don't want you to use the tweet, and I don't want you to change it. So I thought that was that. And then Saturday morning, I get the newspaper, and it was a day that I did not expect to see my name in that newspaper, and there on page C7 of the art section, a page away from the crossword puzzle, which was my destination, there was a full page of blank space with my little Twitter avatar and just a piece of that tweet which said, "I'm going to go listen to the Llewyn Davis soundtrack again, Fare Thee Well, My Honeys." And then, you know, at the bottom, Best Picture of the Year, A.O. Scott, for your consideration. So that set off quite a storm of I don't know what on social media and media blogs, and the public editor of the paper got involved, and there's been great discussion of what the ethics of making that ad were, where the boundaries are between social media and advertisement.
Life will never be the same again, as you pointed out earlier today.
I don't see anything wrong with them taking it, Tony. What's the problem? You said it. You said it in a public medium. You know, your feelings about the movie are clear. I'm sorry that the context is missing. And granted that you didn't give them permission, that's kind of appalling. But I think it's kind of cute. It's a nice break from the all the other, you know, meaningless superlatives.
Yeah, I'm not offended and upset by it. I found it, you know, it was a little surprising, and certainly, you know, got a lot of attention. I mean, it you know, I don't know why they bothered to ask my permission if they were going to go ahead and do it anyway. But that, you know, that happens all the time. Our words are always distorted and twisted and opportunistically used for advertising.
Well, it doesn't sound to me like they distorted your words.
Well, they did. To a certain degree, they did distort his words, because his words existed within the context of kind of bowing out of a completely unrelated conversation, a conversation not at all related to Inside Llewyn Davis, and kind of as a little joke saying, instead of continuing on with this fight about these other two movies, I'm going to go listen to...
Yes, but Colin, now it's the implication is that all the noise of the world, everyone, we all have our own, you know, Wolf of Wall Street debates in our own lives, you know, in different forms, some more serious than others. But we can take a break and revel in this, you know, exquisite folk music.
Maybe it can become a meme for I'm stepping out of this conversation, this angry conversation, about anything.
I'm leaving the Appalachian Trail, and I'm going to listen to Inside Llewyn Davis's soundtrack.
All right, we're going to take a quick break here. We're going to come back. We really do need to talk about those two movies, Wolf of Wall Street and American Hustle. That's what we'll do when we come back. This film is a novelty, yeah. Won't you watch this movie for me? Watch this movie for me.
Watch this movie for me. Mr. Hannah, what can I bring for you on this glorious afternoon?
Well, Hector, here's the game plan. You're going to bring us two absolute martinis. You know how I like them, straight up. And then precisely 7.5 minutes after that, you're going to bring us two more. Then two more after that, every 5 minutes until one of us passes out.
Excellent strategy, sir.
I'm good with water for now, though. Thank you.
It's his first day on Wall Street. Give him time.
That's Matthew McConaughey and Leo DiCaprio in Wolf of Wall Street. And we're going to talk about that right now. A.O. Scott from The New York Times, David Edelstein from New York Magazine, CBS Sunday Morning, and Fresh Air with us now. Before I get into this, the news desk has just informed me that Chris Christie, in ending his press conference today about the Fort Lee highway shutdown, said, well, I've had enough. I'm going to go listen to the Llewyn Davis soundtrack. So it's really taking off. It's really catching fire.
Yeah.
It's like how you end something that you – you don't want to participate in any anymore. So we just heard a little bit of Wolf from Wall Street. Matthew McConaughey is not a big presence in the film. He's on at the beginning. He's certainly having the comeback of the epic for any actor. It's sort of an amazing couple of years. But, you know, this is another – it's one thing I said earlier today, Tony Scott, is in a way DiCaprio played Gatsby twice this year. He played The Great Gatsby. And this is sort of another one of these stories, right? It's about somebody who – it's an aspirational story. It's a story about trying to rise above the station into which you were born and kind of losing your soul along the way.
Yeah, although the question in this case is if there was ever a soul there to begin with. I think one big difference between The Great Gatsby and The Wolf of Wall Street is the absence of a romantic thread in the story. I mean, Gatsby, we're asked to believe, did it all for love, all for the love of Daisy. Whereas Jordan Belfort, the real-life scammer played by Leo DiCaprio in The Wolf of Wall Street, did it all for the stuff, for money and greed and drugs and
he's sort of Tom Buchanan and Gatsby. Maybe
yeah, no, I think that's right.
I don't know that the comparison to Gatsby is that apt. I mean, I don't think Gatsby really did lose his soul. He was kind of in search of his soul. He did some stupid things to get it, and one we can question his judgment in Daisy. But you know, he's overflowing with soul. He can barely contain his soul. This guy is a complete deadhead, and I think the movie is dead along with him. I don't know how I've been attacked on Twitter, but I find it just amazing that anybody could see this movie and you know, not think of it as an endurance test. It's one of the worst shaped movies I've ever seen. Every scene after scene makes the same point. You see a character for the first time and you know everything about him or her, everything there is to know. Nothing in the next 3 hours is going to surprise you whatsoever. It's like Scarface. It's worse than Scarface because there's no real catharsis. It's just watching Scorsese do another rock concert, a kind of rock concert version of American Greed, and showing off his camera moves and going crazy in a way that I don't care really about the morality of it. People are saying, you know, objections to the film are moralistic. Oh, the movie celebrates him. I don't think it particularly celebrates him. I just think it's an incredibly monotonous movie made by a director who's lost his curiosity about the human condition.
I have very mixed feelings about this movie, and I wrote, I think, one of the most completely ambivalent reviews of my career about it, because I think that there actually is an energy in the filmmaking here that I have not seen in Scorsese's movies in quite a long time.
Hugo was all over the place.
You know, but I found it all over
the
place.
Like
and often a very kind of entertaining, and I was not bored by it. I did not find it an endurance test. I found it in places appalling and enraging as well as outrageous. But I actually thought that it had a great deal of momentum and a great deal of interest in the characters. What I think that it lacked, and I think one of the reasons that there's this very weird, polarized, and I think kind of pointless debate going on about its morals and about its moral perspective on its character, is that it doesn't have one. It does not achieve a sort of any kind of coherent view of the guy. So,
and you know, people, there are a lot of people, you know, these doctrinaire auteurists who auteur critics who try to style themselves as you know, great intellectuals, who I think the deep dark secret is that they're boobs. But they
not naming any names.
No, I'm not going to name any names. But you know,
they know who they are.
They know who they are. If you look at a movie like Taxi Driver, for example, a great American movie, or you look at a movie like Raging Bull, those films that Scorsese made are infused with the point of view of their protagonists, the rage and the mercurial emotion and the longing for a kind of connection. And at the same time, Scorsese is able to stand back and put it in some kind of perspective. He has some distance, and it's that mixture of distance and identification that I think often makes a great work of art. I see no perspective like that in The Wolf of Wall Street. I see a guy who just said, hey, I'm not going to moralize. Let's just party. You know, let's do this as a kind of concert film. And I find that not just unsatisfying, not just morally objectionable, but boring. Really,
I agree with you up until boring. I'm not sure he wasn't trying. I think that he's actually trying precisely to find with these characters exactly that combination of identification and immersion in their lives and their perspectives and critical distance and not succeeding in finding it, and letting his own instincts and his own kind of enthusiasm for the stuff that he's displaying, for just the comic and visual energy that it imparts, run away with him. So I don't necessarily quarrel with your description of it as a concert film. I think that's actually a very good way to see it. But I found it to be often a kind of an interesting show to watch, even if I agree with you, it does not reach the level, the sort of the depth, and also didn't make me. The thing about his greatest movies, of which I would also say The King of Comedy is one, that may be my single favorite Scorsese movie, is that they implicate you and they make you feel queasy and uncomfortable about how much you might sympathize with or like these guys. And that doesn't happen with Jordan Belfort here. Not for lack of trying on DiCaprio's part, I actually think that DiCaprio's performance is really one of the strongest things in the movie, and keeps the movie going even when Scorsese's direction in terms of the shaping of the story gets messy. I think that Scorsese is just always right there and very interesting to watch, and trying in a way to figure out the character as he goes along, and I found that exciting.
But he hasn't been written in any way. I mean, DiCaprio can't really get a hold of the character. The character has these amazing speeches, these big soliloquies that go on and on and on, but the writing itself, the script by Terrence Winter, there's no shading in the character. There's no real development. There's no real development in his consciousness as the film goes along.
One of the scenes that I found very puzzling, and you know, they're one of the things that the movie doesn't really have. It doesn't really have the equivalent of what Martin Sheen was in the movie Wall Street, where there was Martin Sheen. Remember, Martin Sheen plays his father, who's a blue collar guy who's really kind of objecting to all this stuff, you know. And Wolf of Wall Street doesn't really have anybody objecting, of course, except this FBI agent played by Kyle Chandler. And you know, that one of the few scenes that has any tension is a scene that takes place on the boat where the FBI agent and the Wolf of Wall Street. It's a great scene, and they're sort of playing with each other a little bit. And at one point, Leo's character sneers at this FBI agent and says, you know, I want you to think about everything I have when you're going home from work in your crappy suit and your crappy threadbare overcoat, riding the subway with a bunch of other wage slaves. I'm doing my best to summarize this. And then later in the movie, we see that happen. We see this FBI agent riding the subway with a bunch of people who work at McDonald's and stuff like that, and who, you know, who didn't participate in Leo's dream, which is bend the rules, do what you can, put other people's money in your own pockets. But I couldn't figure out what the movie thought at that moment, or what Scorsese thought of
that. That's Scorsese's class snobbery coming in, I think. That's Scorsese's way of rubbing your nose. I mean, I know he's presenting it as a grand irony, but I think unconsciously there's a sense of, you know, look at me, Martin Scorsese. I will never ride the subway again in my life. I don't need to.
I think actually that scene in a number of ways takes the character's view, and it actually, I mean, the Kyle Chandler part of the movie rang always a bit false to me, partly because it seemed like an attempt in not really very good faith to impose some sort of moral presence and say, well, we got to have someone in here like the Martin Sheen character in Wall Street, because you think, I mean, Jordan Belfort's own dad shows up in the person of Rob Reiner, and for a minute you think, oh, he's going to, you know, he's going to tell his son that he's doing wrong, and he joins the company, and he's, you know, he's at the parties with all the strippers and the hookers, and he's, you know, helping him cook the books. So and that's a that kind of dark, cynical, everyone is really like this view of the world is much more central to what the movie's doing.
I think also
you know, that scene on the boat, the problem I had with it is that I just felt like Leonardo DiCaprio is a much stronger actor than Kyle Chandler. And just kind of, I wasn't that the character outsmarted him or out-argued him, but just that DiCaprio kind of outdid him in that scene.
I couldn't disagree more. Kyle Chandler's decision to underplay everything, basically to, you know, in this entire cast of people over-emoting like crazy and speechifying and all of them pounding on their chests in their own way, including Scorsese, I think he made a very sensible decision to be still.
I didn't find that underplayed at all. I found that very sort of very obvious and very kind of telegraphed.
Now Tony's dogs are getting all upset. They have whenever Wolf of Wall Street comes up, they start barking.
They can't say it. But let me just Wolf of Wall Street. But Colin, I just want to say that the Martin Sheen scenes in Wall Street are the sort of the dumbest, the most schematic, the most perishable. Nobody took away his point of view. We now know that, you know, young traders identified with Gordon Gekko. So that's not a good thing to raise. You know, I don't wish that Wolf of Wall Street had that kind of presence. There are other ways to do it without turning it into a very conventional melodrama. So I guess I applaud Scorsese and Terrence Winter for leaving that out.
Yeah, well, he disagreed so much he threw poor Martin Sheen off the roof and departed. So I guess that was his comment on that. All right, let's take a quick break. We're running out of time here. We've covered two of about 20 possible topics.
As the moon is, who cares what picture you see? When you're hugging with your baby, let's roll in a balcony.
Well, I'm shutting down production on The Mammoth Awakes and starting principal photography on Fort Lee with Jonah Hill as Chris Christie. Today's show was produced by Betsy Kaplan and me. Our interns are Jackie Lauper, Anna Novak, and Catherine Pikus. The part of Bill Curry was played by Alan Arkin. Greg Hill starred in our introduction and introducing Lydia Brown as the ingenue. For articles, links, videos, and photos of the Faith Middleton Show staff dressed in costumes from The Hunger Games, visit our great website, WNPR.org. On tomorrow's show, the nose goes inside Chris Christie. Ugh. And now, back to Colin.
All right, we're back. Our guests are David Edelstein, a film critic for New York Magazine, Fresh Air, and CBS Sunday Morning. A.O. Scott, film critic for the New York Times. We only have about 10 minutes left, and I mean, I've got a list of topics as long as your arm. Is there someplace you guys want to go? I mean, I feel like we should be talking about American Hustle as the bookend to the conversation about Wolf of Wall Street, but... I could be talked
about. It's a delightful, rollicking movie by a director who loves actors and winds them up and lets them go. It's got this wonderful Preston Sturges momentum. It's full of this sort of, you know, retro kitsch, outrageous 70s decors and costumes and hairstyles. And I think it gets at the sort of crazy, corrupt, and both farcical and tragic element of, you know, American public life, you know, criminality and its prosecution, and how inevitably that prosecution fails or takes down the wrong people or has absolutely no impact. The great show of American politics. I think that movie really, really nails it and is a joy to boot,
well,
a lark.
And does it in a very humane way. I mean, what I enjoyed about that movie and appreciated the most was how much affection it shows for the characters and how, you know, you have these con men and these criminals and these politicians, and, you know, they're all messed up in all kinds of ways. None of them is a particularly morally admirable person, but they're all real people in some way. They have feelings, they have desires, they have aspirations, they have insecurities. It does come down on the side of some of them, but it's not. There's not a sort of a good guy bad guy schematic.
But
there.
It's not like you want to go out and, you know, imitate what they're doing. You see that, you know, they're
well.
Their
I do want to imitate the hair that Christian Bale has.
Let's hear a little tiny bit of them.
Desperate and sad at the same time. I mean, it's a very humanistic movie, but
yeah.
I wouldn't say that it you know, it glorifies these characters or it lets them off the hook.
Let's hear
not
a conversation between the con man Irving Rosenfeld, played by Christian Bale, his cunning partner and lover Sidney Prosser, played by Amy Adams, and the crazy FBI agent Richie DeMaso, played by Bradley Cooper.
You're going to do this because you got no choice. You work for me.
You keep changing the rules. No, you're getting a little power drunk, Richard. You know, you want to tell him anything? You want to wake him up?
Oh, no, I said we shouldn't do any of it, Irving. You know I said that. So now I support Richie. He's got vision. Do it heavy or don't do it.
What does that mean? I mean, he's the one ruining America, not me.
Am I ruining America?
Because people just got over Watergate and Vietnam, all right? And you're going to all over politicians again? Hey, just because you want to be a big shot, get a promotion.
No, promotion. I'm thinking big. All right, this is going to be fantastic. We're doing video surveillance. I'm doing this from the feet up.
You will never do it properly because you got too much government attitude to be small and sleek. I'm like the Viet Cong, man, all right? I'm in and I'm out. I was there the whole time. You don't know it, all right? That's an art of becoming somebody who people can pin their beliefs and their dreams on.
Right. That's Christian Bale at the end there. I mean, this really is an incredibly delightful movie. And I have this pet theory that a lot of these movies are either The Great Gatsby or The Music Man. And The Music Man, and this is The Music Man. It's about a con man who kind of falls in love with his marks to a certain degree.
But there is also this thing that recurs in David O. Russell. David O. Russell, to me, I think he's now my favorite, you know, American director under 50. I guess he's over 50 now. But let's pretend he's under 50. There's this way that the con man sees the chiselers, the sort of petty chiselers, do have a vision of the bottom of society, and they can still see what it means to sort of look up from the top. They see things that, for example, allegedly Chris Christie and his cohort don't see when they're looking down at the traffic jam on the bridge. They don't see what the FBI sees. They see what the FBI, embodied by Chris, by Bradley Cooper, you know, doesn't see
in this movie. And that's, as I said, that's the same perspective that you get in his masterpiece, Three Kings, about the Iraq, the first Iraq war, and a lot of his other films to boot.
You know, Tony Scott, this is a movie about kind of small-time players, and Wolf of Wall Street is about slightly higher flyers, but not the really high flyers. And there's even a moment where Leo DiCaprio says to Kyle Chandler, why aren't you going after these other guys, the really, really big players? And, you know, to a certain degree, we've seen a lot of movies this year that are about the corrupting of something. Even Inside Llewyn Davis, to a certain degree, is about the gradual monetization of this, you know, this naive folk scene that it's going to be converted into a lot of Peter, Paul, and Mary records and stuff like that. But what we don't see, what we really haven't seen very much, is the movie about what happened to this nation 5 years ago when the people that Leo's talking about, the people way up the ladder, really, really victimized a lot of Americans, more Americans than Christian Bale's character could ever dream of hurting. And I'm wondering, is it just a matter of waiting for that movie to be made, or is it hard to make for some reason?
Well, I mean, I think there have been a couple attempts. I mean, I agree with you, and you know, compared to Jordan Belfort, you know, and his little penny stock company Stratton Oakmont, the big investment banks and brokerage houses responsible for the. I mean, he was nothing compared to what was done in 2008 and running up to it.
And what was happening above that by people like Rubin and
yes.
Lawrence Summers and
exactly.
and the people who frankly colluded with them in yeah. You know, in our government, in the highest echelons of our government. That movie has been made as a documentary.
As a documentary called Inside Job
yeah.
which is one of the best movies of the last 5 years. And on a smaller scale, J.C. Chandor's first movie, Margin Call, I think did a pretty good job of going inside the bubble.
I thought it was did a terrific job.
Yeah, no, it's wonderful.
It's done as a disaster movie.
Yeah.
This is perfect. I'm so glad you mentioned that, Tony, because there is a movie from the point of view of the people at the top
yes.
that at the same time, you know, who are doing these absolutely horrible things
yes.
desperately in order to stave off disaster. And it's like a disaster movie. And
yeah.
we identify them. And at the same time, everything that they're doing makes us sick. We have this larger awareness of how their self-interest, you know, is on a collision course, you know, with the good of the country.
Yeah.
And it's an extremely powerful and very underrated movie.
No, it's a brilliant movie. And just to get a little bit off topic, J.C. Chandor made another brilliant movie this year, All Is Lost, with Robert Redford, which I think, just to go way out on an interpretive limb here, is partly an allegorical version of the same story about the sort of a man who thinks he's the master of the universe discovering that that the universe has other plans. But I do think that most of the time the stories that we get either are allegories about power and its corruption, or are these kind of are concentrated on the lower levels of society than the very top, and on the sort of the corruption of values. I think you saw a lot of movies in the Wolf of Wall Street vein this year. Going back to the spring, there were Spring Breakers, there was Pain and Gain, there was The Bling Ring, all of which paint a very similar portrait of a society that has been just completely hollowed out by materialism and is functioning in the absence of any other values. And any other ways of connecting to the world or to others.
And I have to say, amassing a great deal of evidence, but not always a great deal of what I would say is true art.
We're going to have to end on that note. David Edelstein from New York Magazine, CBS Sunday Morning, and Fresh Air, Tony Scott from the New York Times, thank you so much for joining us. We'll be back tomorrow with the notes.
All right, this is the first time I've been back here in 2 weeks, Kyle, and so I may be totally rusty, so.
You're going to be fine. Welcome back, by the way. Okay, and action.
Frankly, Scarlett, I don't really feel like Chinese food tonight.
Cut! That was not the exact line in the script, Greg, but you know, I think we can work from this.